Welcome back to the Exotic Pet Collective. My name is Richard. I'm so glad that you tuned in again for another exciting episode because we got a really cool guest. This is somebody I've been trying to get on the podcast for a while, and I was finally able to kind of pin him down and convince them to do it. He's a busy man, very busy man, located out in, where is he? In California, in the Los Angeles area. If you listen to the past podcast with Jay Rodriguez, this gentleman is a tarantula dealer to the stars. Very excited to have him on the podcast. Everybody, give a warm welcome to Wilderness Nate from Micro Wilderness.
Hey, guys. Good to meet you.
Hey, Nate, how's everything going out there in California?
Fantastic. Weather's great. Well, kind of. We're in the worst drought in California history, but it's nice today.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, it is hot as daisies out here. It's kind of ridiculous. So I had to turn the air conditioner off to do this, so I might start sweating as halfway through. But I really appreciate you coming on. I know you're a busy guy, and you got a lot going on over there, breeding and selling and all that stuff. So thank you for taking the time.
Be here.
Yeah, very. For people that you maybe aren't in the United States or just aren't familiar with you, can you just kind of introduce yourself and tell everybody who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Nate Villarreal. I go by Wilderness Nate on Facebook and Insta. I run a store called microwilderness.com that deals with invertebrates, mainly tarantulas, but we do scorpions, beetles, and we do some reptiles as well. That's pretty much me.
So what kind of reptiles are you dealing with?
So we breed ball pythons. There's none currently available on the site right now. Right now, I think we have some leopard geckos and crested geckos on the website.
Very cool.
But we deal in a bunch of weird reptiles as well, like green-keeled lizards. We just got into a collared lizard breeding project.
Yeah.
Colombian rainbow boas and a bunch of other like randos, like house snakes and whatnot.
Very awesome. But mainly, what I know you for mainly is tarantulas. A lot of tarantulas from you. You've been very kind to the channel. You've had some really good ads. For a long time, I think you were one of the first businesses that, opted to run an integrated ad in one of my videos. So, I have a soft spot in my heart for you and what you do, you've been such a big supporter.
For sure. I've always loved your channel. And honestly, you really ushered my hobby, greatly.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've learned so much about tarantulas just through you, man.
Oh, thank you so much. So you are pretty, I don't know how famous is the right word, but you're known for doing some really cool, going out into nature and, I just see you post on Instagram and Facebook all the time, out in the California, I don't know if it's deserts or scrublands or what do they call that, but, just finding cool reptiles and inverts and tarantulas and you also have some of the best selection of a fauna pelma species out there. And real quick, I want to thank the sponsor of today's podcast, and that is Arthropod Ambassadors. Now, if you're not familiar with them, they take a unique look at our tiny neighbors that wear their bones on their skin. They aim to spark interest in bugs and support the well-being of arthropods in our backyard and around the world. They're spreading this educational inspiration through Arthropod Art, the mobile bug zoo, informational YouTube videos, and invertebrate hobby networking. They also work with edible insects, specimen preservation, pest management, and beekeeping. From compost-enhancing roly-polies and alien-like top predator mantises to the honeybee alchemist we partnered with long ago, arthropods come in all shapes and sizes and are waiting to teach us more about the earth that we all have in common. If you're interested in becoming more familiar with mantises, jumping spiders, assassin bugs, roaches, or a variety of other critters, head over to arthropodambassadors.com and check out their content on which species they have available. You can also find a collection of videos covering nature walks, pet mantises, resin art, and other invertebrates on their YouTube channel, also called Arthropod Ambassadors. And you can follow them on Instagram to stay updated on new educational content or species that they may have available in the future. So a huge thanks to Arthropod Ambassadors for sponsoring this podcast, and I will leave a link down below in the show notes so you can check out their website and all their other social media. How'd you get into all that?
But I tried to specialize in a fauna pelma. Herping, I've just always loved doing it. I've always loved just coming across wildlife, not just reptiles and amphibians, but like arachnids, big mammals, big game. the Fauna Pelma thing, I just fell in love with that genus many years ago when I came across my first wild Iodius. That was probably back in 2008. I just fascinated just seeing like a gigantic tarantula. It's like seeing a dragon in the wild, you know? but seeing snakes, rattlesnakes, and even the smallest fence lizards are always still a surprise for me.
Yeah, I agree. Unfortunately, out here in West Virginia, I mean, we've got a lot of reptiles and amphibians and stuff, but nothing as cool as what you can find out there in California. And for I was sure. actually, I remember being, I had to go to LA with my wife and her family for mm-hmm. a wedding. This was years ago. But you and I had just started getting to know each other. And apparently I was kind of in your neighborhood, if I'm remembering correctly. Was that you? Was that even you?
It was me. And okay. That invite is still open.
Yeah. You invited me to go out. And I'm weird about meeting people in public. So there was you, and I think there was also somebody else that hit me up when I posted I was in LA. I think it was the other guy, but he was like, you know, my family, we're going out into the desert with some dune buggies and ATVs. We'd love to have you. And like my first thought was, I don't know who you are. I'm not going to go out into the desert with a stranger.
Oh, they were ATVs, not dune buggies.
Was that you?
That was me.
Well, no offense, but I was just kind of like, oh, I don't know about that.
I totally get it. But if you're ever back in this area, let's go out.
Definitely, definitely.
But you brought up a Fauna Pelma, and that's like my favorite genus of spiders.
Yeah.
We have this whole program where it's not even a program. It's just what me do or what I do.
Yeah.
Micro wilderness is my hobby. So this is the biggest part of my hobby is breeding the native species and releasing half of my production back into the wild. And it's, you know, I like to do it just because I do collect the parents and like some other specimens. And I like to give back just because they produce so slowly out there, you know?
Yeah. So you'll go out into, I feel like an idiot because I'm not too familiar with the environment in California, even though sure. I, you know, visited a few times. So is it considered like when you're out in like the Santa Monica Hills or wherever you're going out, is that, what is that even considered?
Well, so the Santa Monica Hill is right by my area because I live in Santa Monica.
Okay.
It's all forest out here.
Okay.
But in LA, within an hour, we could get forest, desert. We could have like scrubland, creosote, like bushland, like plains. So we have like all sorts of terrain just an hour from us.
Yeah.
We have like accesses to like several different species of Fauna Pelma within an hour's drive.
Yeah.
Yeah. The main two I work with are Eutalinum and Steindachneri.
Okay. Very cool. Yeah. You've posted some of Fauna Pelma species, you know, whether it's on Instagram or on your website, but I wasn't even really that familiar with them. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. Like when I was out there, I was looking for anything, any tarantula, and I didn't know where to go or, yeah, who to talk to, and you know, we're there for a wedding and to see family that she only gets to see every few years. So it was
for
like
sure.
Focus was on like that was a priority. But every now and then to be like, you know, we had our kid with us and we could leave him with the relatives and sneak off and go hiking. So it was like I'm just doing quick Google searches, like, and I came across a tarantula hill. I was like, oh, this is perfect, and we were gonna sneak out.
Did you find anything?
Nothing.
Oh, I mean,
we found some spiders and a couple of burrows.
I do remember that video of yours actually.
Yeah, and I was like. Kind of, I mean, I don't want to say I'm frustrated because, you know, they might listen to this, but it was like we were going to sneak out in the morning. Like it was, you know, early, you know, it was like 7-8 o'clock in the morning. We're going to run out and hopefully catch somebody, you know, some tarantulas moving around or something. And the family caught wind of it. I'm like, that sounds like fun. So they all wanted to come, and, you know, and that's like 15 people that were on bed and breakfast, or not, it wasn't an Airbnb. Oh, yeah, it was an Airbnb, but like some of her family from town, they just stayed with us in this big house and they all wanted to come. So that like added 90 minutes to the
gosh.
So it's like we couldn't just bounce. We had to wait for everybody to get showered and dressed and put on sunscreen and pack little day packs. And I'm like, it's going to be too hot and sunny. And, you know, people have been walking all over and scaring everything away. It's like it kind of ruined the whole premise. But it's like,
and that's the whole thing, too. I don't think you found anything that day because I usually find them at night.
Okay.
They usually hang out outside of their holes, like right as the sun goes down.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah, I was hoping going early morning would be good, but we didn't actually get there until like 10 a.m. or something.
<For sure. laughs>
The sun was like all the way up in the sky. And, you know,
yeah.
But even then, we went to Scorpion Canyon a couple days later. And that we were doing at, you know, around sunset. It was just my wife and I. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we didn't really have much luck there either. But I think, again, it was like I just wasn't going to the right places. And,
right,
you know, it looked like that area had recently been scorched by one of the fires. You know, everything was pretty burnt down.
Sure. And that happens a lot here in the L.A. Basin, unfortunately. Yeah.
So what when that happens, do the tarantulas move? Or, I mean, do they just kind of burrow down deep and are safe? Or do they end up dying? Like, I've always wondered about that.
Most of the time they end up dying just because a lot of their holes are just like, you know, like a foot deep, and it's not enough to escape the heat from the fires.
Yeah.
That's one of the places, like when we collect and we breed, I do try to seed some in those areas as well if I knew that there were some tarantulas in that area, just to help them out a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very cool. So you're kind of doing like what they do in Mexico these days, right? Like you collect a couple of adults from the wild, you bring them into your I don't even know what you call that, your business or like your
yeah, I guess I rent room. A house bigger than my house just for the spiders. Oh, wow.
that's pretty crazy in Santa Monica. I can only imagine. So you bring them in there, you pair them, they produce an egg sac, you get the spiderlings, you find out which ones are viable, and when they get to like a healthy kind of substantial size, like I mean like where they can at least fend for themselves,
you'll take them back
out and reintroduce them into the wild.
Correct. And you know, it's not like in the scale of Mexico, this is just me doing like one or two sacks a year, you know, just because I want to. But we wait till their second instar. And we actually don't feed them because I don't want to contaminate the babies with any sort of microbes from like captive bred like feeders.
Interesting.
And then we release them at that point.
Very cool. And you know, they're a fauna pelma species, so it takes they live decades. So it takes a good 5-6 years before they really start putting on some major size.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, these guys hopefully will live. You know, they are in a sterile environment because everything was burnt down. So.
Yeah, that's very true. So when you're just like, this is more just my own curiosity. Like when you do something like that, like you take the parents from the wild to breed, are their offspring considered captive bred, or like what kind of classification?
Well,
they
are
technically bred in captivity, but they're wild specimens.
So they are wild. Captive bred, just cause, it's not like I took a gravid specimen out of the wild. It's more that I bred them in captivity and then they produced.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I figured. Yeah. I just didn't know exactly where the line was.
Oh, no. I think a wild-caught specimen would be like if I found like an egg sac or I found a gravid female and produced in captivity.
Yeah, like the people that go to the pet store and buy like a curly-haired tarantula that produces an egg sac a month later. They're like, what the heck?
No, and it's funny because I was... I saw an article by Petco saying that all the tarantulas they carry were captive bred. I know that's not true.
That's interesting. I mean, I know there for a little bit, my local Petco, and this is actually like when I really first started growing my collection, like after my dad died, you know, I went from just a few to, you know, a few dozen. And it was because I went to Petco and they had little Brachypelma homori slings. And they were like in those big spice jars with like a sponge at the bottom.
Oh, yeah. I totally remember that.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, it's a little tiny baby tarantula. And I actually kind of scammed them, which is terrible. But I brought it home and did one of those dumb, because I had always, all the tarantulas I had always gotten full grown. You know, they were adults that I got at expos or, you know, little mom and pop shops or something like that. This was like the first spiderling I got. So I'm like doing a lot of research online. This, you know, this is years ago. And, I was I don't know. I just was anxious for it to be full grown. You know, so I was like, I had built this, you know, large 5-gallon style enclosure and, you know, brought it home. And, you know, it was like at that moment, like I knew it was probably a little big, but it wasn't until I had it home and was looking at the sling and had like the little spice, you know, container thing they had kept inside the enclosure. I was like, this is way too big. It could just walk right out of the vents and the lid. Like, so I was like, well, I got a little Tupperware, like little plastic container and kind of scooped out the substrate from the big enclosure I had built and set up a small one for it. But in the process of moving it from its, you know, what it was in when I bought it at the store into that, little enclosure I built, it escaped. Like it just kind of ran in and ran back out and then disappeared in the enclosure. And I was like, oh no, I don't know where it is. It kind of like just went under something and like burrowed, and I didn't want to like hurt it by trying to dig it up. So I, and it had molted in between that time. So like there was a molt inside of the little box. So I just took the spice container back to Petco and showed them the molt in there. And was like, I think this is, it died. And they're like, oh, so sorry. Here, have another one. And then I was like, I wasn't very honest, but I feel, I lost the tarantula. I was like, it's in this enclosure. I don't know where it is. It's going to escape, just crawl through one of the holes. So, and I don't remember how much it was. It was way more than it should have been. I know that.
Yeah, no, they charge a grip over there for sure.
Yeah. So I just want the little baby tarantula. So I did that. And then, of course, like a week later, I see it like crawling across the substrate. So I scoop it up. I was like, two for one.
That's awesome.
But yeah.
Petco's buy one, get one free deal. They don't even know.
But I didn't do it again. I was like, that worked once, but I'm not going to push my luck. They're nice people to me. So I don't want to take advantage of them. I just wanted the sling, and I felt like an idiot. And that I believe was probably Captain Bread, because but it was like that was very short lived. They only did that maybe for a year, and then they went back to having full grown or juvenile tarantulas. And some of them, for a while, at least the one where I lived, they just had avicularias for a minute, like just your basic pink toes, and they all looked like males. I was like, somebody is sexing out males and selling them to Petco just to clear them out.
Just a theory on that, though, is, keeping slings is pretty, pretty specialized. So people probably had trouble keeping the little tarantulas alive.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, they probably complained to the Petco heads,
Yeah. I'm sure it was much easier for them to get the slings. But yeah, they're definitely, and they don't sell anything there for spiderlings. You know what I mean? So if you're trying to upsell, they don't have the enclosures that you would need for slings, or, even like the little tiny, they're geared more for like for adults, adult tarantulas or large reptiles and stuff. And again, at least I'm just speaking about the Petco in my small town. So it's like, it's probably has the lowest variety
in the big city Petcos like here and wherever I've been, I haven't seen very much tarantula like gear or accessories either.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So they're just more of like a reptile fish thing.
Yeah. I mean, they started carrying some of those little acrylic enclosures. I think who does that? Zilla, maybe?
The arboreal ones.
Yeah. They got little invert ones, but I'm personally not a fan of those. So
same here.
I'm not really going to buy those, but I thought it was cool. I was like, finally, you got an enclosure that at least you can sell to some teenage kid that's buying his first tarantula that isn't, wildly incorrect. So
for sure.
Props for that. But yeah, I have mixed feelings about those kind of pet stores, which is why I think people doing what you do is very important and very helpful for the hobby. You've got a good selection of captive bred reptiles and inverts and stuff. And, it was really cool talking to Jay Rodriguez and hearing him drop your name so much and just kind of
rave. I was so flattered.
Like he seemed to really enjoy his experiences with you. And he mentioned, who was it? He said that when he was talking to you, you mentioned there was a cast member of Mad TV that kept tarantulas.
Oh, that's Deb Wilson. I was actually hanging out with her last night.
No way.
Yeah, no, she comes over every so often. I wanted to bring her up during our talks because she is a subscriber to you and she loves your channel. So I want to shout out Deborah Wilson from Mad TV.
That is awesome.
Yeah, she is one of my biggest supporters of the business as a whole. She got me into scorpions. She got me breeding groups of like emperors, cave claws, a really rare scorpion called the Swammerdamy, which is the largest scorpion in the world.
Oh, wow.
And also another one called the Mycerensis. It's a pretty big Asian forest scorpion as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, but she's so passionate about scorpions. She comes over and just surprises me with these giant groups of scorpions every so often.
That's so cool. Yeah, I remember, watched a lot of Mad TV back in the day. It was like, I remember when it first came on, I always liked SNL, but there was just something about their style of humor I found a lot more. I mean, but I was also in my early 20s, so I kind of like the more
for sure.
But yeah, I was a big fan of hers. And when he said that, I was like, there's no way.
Yeah, no,
she had a hard time believing it.
Like, she's so passionate about her exotic animal keeping, for sure. Like, her terrariums are so wild. Yeah. Little caves everywhere, little heating elements in every little corner for them.
That's very cool. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was interesting in that Jay was into him. Because, you know, for some, I don't know why, but I just never thought anybody that was in Hollywood, you know, doing the showbiz thing would, you know, they would really ever be into something. Like, they would keep, you know, I could see him keeping tigers or like crazy snakes or monkeys or something, but tarantulas and inverts, I guess I was stereotyping people. But
so when I was working at Mattel as a corporate toy artist, I actually worked with Billie Eilish's dad, and he would talk about how his daughter would like just like to play with tarantulas, and a year later she came out with that video where it was coming out of her mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember seeing her on something. She had a male GBB. I don't remember what that was. It was like one of those late night talk shows, possibly or something. I don't know if she brought him on stage or they were at her house doing an interview or something. But I was like, I remember seeing that and being like, oh, tarantulas are about to, the hobby's about to take a big leap forward. You know, like a major pop star is talking about her pet tarantula. Like that's going to do some cool things for the species in general, the genus.
For sure. And, you know, there's a lot of interest. I've done gigs where I've done like tarantula, like handling for music videos and stuff.
Yeah.
As well. I'm trying to remember the last band I did. They were out of Australia, but they hired me for, Mature Chaco just walking across the screen. That was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That was something I was always curious about, being that you're based in the LA area. You know, like, what kind of exposure you would have to, you know, I mean, just kind of like getting jobs. Cause I get calls every now and then from casting directors, you know, wanting, you know, like to be on some stupid pet trick show or, you know, something like that. And they usually find out I'm in West Virginia and they would have to fly me out and the tarantulas. They're like, yeah, no, we're not going to do that. But I'm like, you're right there. You know, you got these connections. And, I even had one guy hit me up. He was a movie producer or director. And for some reason, he thought I was in Oregon. because he had reached out to,
interesting.
Oh, what's his name? Peter Clausen from Bugs in Cyberspace. Cause they were like shooting a movie up there and they needed some tarantulas for one of their shots.
Man.
And they reached out to him, but he had just recently moved to Arizona. I was like, I'm not out there anymore. I can't help you out, but you know, you should talk to this guy, Richard, and gave him my information. And so they assumed I was doing the same thing he was doing in the same area. But really what he gave him my information because he was like, who's got some really good footage? He could probably just sell you some footage. So like, I talked to the guy for, you know, probably half an hour. And then he like was wanting to know when I could, you know, come by. And I was like, well, I'd have to fly out of Pittsburgh and get a flight and find, you know, probably have to ship the tarantulas down there. And I was like, wait, what? It's like, you're not here in town. It's like, well, we got to find somebody that's closer by. And I was like, oh, okay. It was disappointing.
For sure.
But it seems like there's a need for that out there. So, I mean, like, how often do you kind of get involved in the whole showbiz aspect?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
What's all around you, almost everywhere you look, and makes your life better? Birds. Learn all about these beautiful creatures in this wonderful new podcast called Birds of a Feather Talk Together. Two experts guide two newbies on their journey to learn more. Mallard ducks, ivory-billed woodpeckers, Hawaiian honeycreepers, blue jays, cardinals, sandhill cranes, and more. Each week we discuss a different bird and walk away with a better understanding of the birds all around us. Oh, and we have a ton of fun doing it. Listen now. You're going to like learning about these birds. I guarantee it.
Well, so we get hit up a lot for it, actually, but I usually turn those gigs down just because of liabilities. I don't want to be the guy that has to deal with someone getting bit by a tarantula or getting haired or something, you know?
Yeah. I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, but I do take them up once in a while, especially if I know like the producer or whoever needs it.
So like working in LA and doing what you do, like before you got into tarantulas and breeding and stuff, like what kind of jobs did you have out there? I mean, you mentioned at Mattel.
Yeah, so I used to be a toy artist in Mattel. I owned an art company where we sold painted toys as well, or hand-painted toys. Before that, I was a Marlboro sales rep.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, selling cigarettes to people at the bars. yeah, and prior to the Marlboro experience, I was actually in flight school. I went to school to be a pilot, and okay. I never did anything with that.
So you have a pilot's license, or you did?
I did, yeah. But I have glaucoma as well, so my pilot's license is limited. So I decided not to go through a career with that, and it's more of like a recreational thing now.
Yeah, that's very cool. So you live in Santa Monica, and I'm trying to remember. I remember we flew into LAX, and we were driving out because we weren't in Malibu, but we had to we drove up the coast to Malibu, and then cut through the Malibu mountain range. I don't know what the heck that is. We drove through some beautiful scenery, went through a little tunnel,
sure,
and it went from foggy beach to beautiful forest or whatever, and we drove through.
Oh
there,
yeah,
and then we
That's
went
the
to like
Topanga Mountains.
Yeah. And then wherever we were staying, it was really hot and flat. So it was we kind of came out of the mountains into a desert valley. And then that's where we were.
Oh, cool.
So, I don't even know. It was just California is just weird to me. Just the way that it goes from beach to mountains to desert. So when you're looking out, for tarantulas or, whatever. What are the ideal places to look for something?
Well, that's a complicated question because it's all species dependent.
Right.
The ones here by my house in Santa Monica are the Steindachneri tarantulas, which are pure black Afana pelma. Those guys actually live on mountainsides and cliffsides. So I have to catch them out of their holes rather than try to find them anywhere else. Whereas, stuff like the Iotis or Eutalinum prefer flat ground, and they'll make a burrow straight through that ground. And those are the tarantulas that are easiest to find because you could walk up, see a hole covered in web, and know there's a tarantula there, and just kind of pour water into it, and they come running out, you know?
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So is it difficult? To me, it seems like it would be a difficult thing, but I watch your, I look at your posts and, that lens is social media. So you most people only post their successes and not their failures.
Sure.
So it looks
it's
kind of really
me
easy.
Too. First couple years, it was darn near impossible to find a female tarantula. I'd find the males walking around all over the place, but the females, you're not looking for the spider, you're looking for the burrow. Yeah. So it's just kind of having the eye for just a little bit of webbing around the front of the burrow or just a leg sticking out,
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's especially difficult because we do this in the middle of the night. Yeah. And we usually have to find the tarantula 5 to 10 feet away from the actual spider just because the vibrations will scare them back into the burrows.
And it's not like hunting scorpions. You can't use a black light or something and get them to light up.
Scorpions are easy mode. You can see a scorpion from 50 feet away if you shine a strong black light over your head.
Yeah. Now, do you worry at all? You're out there, in the mountains or the deserts or the scrublands in California in the middle of the night looking for tarantulas. And tarantulas are the least of the worry out there. I mean, you've got venomous snakes. Are they bobcats or cougars or mountain lions, whatever they are?
Pumas, bobcats, coyotes. In some areas, we have some wild boar as well.
Oh, goodness.
But, sometimes. But, I never go alone in those super desolate areas. And so wildlife like that usually gets scared off when groups of people are around.
Okay.
So we have encountered some big game, but never a problem.
Yeah. What about people? Charles Manson types that are out there in the wilderness?
It does happen, yes. Usually in the public land, Bureau of Land Management land. We're usually armed in those areas, though.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. I feel like, but I mean, California is a lot different than West Virginia. So a lot of times people go out in the forest out here. There might be a rattlesnake or something, maybe a bear, but occasionally a mountain lion. But they're pretty rare, so there's not a lot that can get you. But still, people, they might carry a pistol or have a rifle on their back or something like that. But I was man, if I was out in California, I don't know if I'd want to go running around like that.
In California, we're allowed to carry only in certain areas, public federal land.
Okay.
And that's usually where I carry, and that's usually where I look to. Yeah, because imagine tromping around in the mountains not being protected in any means.
Yeah, come across a mountain lion, I would be a little worried.
Yeah, for sure.
But
I have seen them, and they're pretty reclusive. I wouldn't say they're friendly creatures, but they usually wouldn't attack.
Yeah, and I think that's like the difference from actually being somewhere and then just seeing reports, because hear right. people talk about it. Mountain lions are strolling in people's backyards and snatching up kids and dogs. And
yeah, no, that's pretty rare. So I'm not too worried about that stuff.
Now, do you typically have to go pretty far out in like the desolate areas? Or because I know when we were there, we were doing a lot of hiking and a lot of the trails were like right in LA. It was like you'd park in a parking lot, mm-hmm. but then you would just kind of like walk the trail, go over a hill, and then it seemed desolate. But I knew we're just 5 minutes from Starbucks, right. You know what I mean?
I go looking in really desolate areas. Public land is real far out from the cities, hundreds of miles from the cities. So I do that. And also I have a few friends down by Descanso, which is by Mexico, just east of LA, or not east of San Diego, okay. who own big spots of land, which I also work out of. Because not only are we doing the tarantula stuff in that land, but we're also harvesting manzanita, which is a hardwood for the pet trade under his company.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my boy, Sean Bailey. So just shouting out to him.
Yeah. What is his company?
Oh, he wholesales it out under his personal banner.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Very neat.
Yeah. But so it's Big Berry Manzanita. It's just a nice hardwood we use for like aquariums and reptile enclosures and whatnot.
Yeah. So what other places are you out in like Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico? You ever go out in those areas?
Yeah. So constantly Arizona, twice a year in Texas. New Mexico is one of those things where we're just venturing into, because there's only one species we're working over there with, and it's the Afanapelma gabelli.
Okay.
But California, I'm constantly strolling it. I've made it my job to wander.
Now the Afanapelma Johnny Cashy is from California. Like, do you ever come across those in the wild?
So very rarely. It's way out of my area. The two spots I know of are about 6 to 8 hours from my house, so it's a little hard to get to.
I can imagine.
And also there are a lot harder to find than the tarantulas down here.
Yeah. That's a weird thing about California. I mean, if you go from the northernmost tip of California to the southern, like how long of a drive is that?
I just got back from Sacramento, which is, just barely Northern California. And that took us 8 hours from LA to Sac. So I would assume 14 hours.
Yeah. It's like just driving up the entire coast.
I couldn't imagine.
Yeah, it feels, it's just a weird shaped state. So sometimes it's like, you say California, but it encompasses a wide variety of environments, it seems. I mean, whether you're going east to west or north to south. So when you're like looking for tarantulas out there, mm-hmm. you're taking into consideration the environment and which species is out there. So are there like certain species that, are, I don't want to say easier to find, but I mean, like how do you determine, like, is there a demand in the hobby, or are you looking more for like species that need to be bred and released, or like how do you decide what it is you're going to go out and search for?
Oh, well, my main criteria is what's the most interesting to firstly me, but okay. also the hobby. I usually search for like the Stein Dachneri just because that's one I've been trying to just produce in captivity. I've never been able to produce them. I've never even sold one. So we're working with that. Eutalonum, when you bring up like an easiness level or like trying to find a spider, that one is the most accessible to us because it, I don't know, its habitat is so close to like the cities. It's like flat plains. We could actually walk it, unlike the Stein Dachneri where we have to go climb mountains to get. Let's see. The Iotis is also a pretty interesting one I like to work with just because it's found in like very, very dry desert environments. And it's just one I stumble into when I'm just out doing stuff in the desert,
Yeah. And when you find and collect one of these, male and female pair from the wild, mm-hmm. and you bring them home, is it much more difficult to breed them in captivity when they, you know, have been removed from the wild? Or
absolutely. Yeah. You have to take into consideration the stress factors of being, you know, removed from a burrow you've been in for, you know, 10 years.
Yeah.
And also we have to like replicate the triggers that they experience in the wild, like the winter seasons that they experience where it gets super cold and sometimes snowy in the desert. Mm-hmm. That's kind of hard to replicate here, just inside a house, you know. Also, being in the desert, they experience 120 degrees sometimes. And so we have to replicate that. Not exactly 120 degrees because they are underground for most of the day, but. You know, yeah. We have to heat them up and then put them in like coolers in the winter.
Interesting. So you, from the time of collection to the time that you have a viable egg sac produced, like how much time are you looking at as far as like an investment?
You know, like 2 years or so per specimen. Yeah. Yeah. That's, so it's about a year to acclimate and then the following year to breed.
That's pretty impressive. Like when you think about it, or at least me, like here's what I talk about. It's like, oh, they scoop them up and they bring them home and they breed them with like within a week. And then a couple months later, they got egg sacs. But like when I start thinking about logically, I'm like, it's probably nowhere near as easy as that.
Yeah, no, it's 2 years. And the Stein project's been going on for about 5 years now and still nothing. But you know, it's a labor of love. So I enjoy every process of it, step of it. Yeah.
So when we're talking to Fauna Pelmas, you mentioned some that are like one of the reasons I was excited when I got my first, and it's still a spiderling, but I got one of those Fauna Pelma Johnny Cashies is because I was like, I really want a black Fauna Pelma.
Sure.
But you've mentioned a few other species that are also black. And then I know mm-hmm. Jay mentioned a species that was more of a white, like not so much blonde, but had a more of a white coloration. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Fauna Pelma species white.
that might be it.
Well, so there's two that I know of. There's a Mexican Fauna Pelma called the Fauna Pelma species white, which okay. is literally a white tarantula. But also certain locales of the Fauna Pelma iotis, the desert tarantula, are white as well.
I think that was the one he was referring to because iotis yeah. sounds pretty familiar. You know, but the like what are some, other than the Johnny Cashy, what are some really cool, and I think the Utilum, or however you say that, maybe that one is, but what are some cool black, like solid black tarantulas?
So the Utilum is, that's a weird one because they change colors. Sometimes they're black, sometimes they're bluish, sometimes they're like just the normal brown of Fauna Pelma. It all depends on their like molt and age. The Fauna Pelmas in the Paloma complex, the dwarf Fauna Pelmas, are usually black as well. Like the species Mojave, Paloma.
I'm not really familiar with that species. There's a dwarf of Fauna Pelma?
There's several, yes. And they're all like within like an inch or two big.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and their demeanors are...
They're all in like the Southwest United States? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so mainly Arizona and Cali, we have these dwarf Fauna Pelmas. These guys don't have the normal Fauna Pelma demeanor either. At least the ones I've encountered in the wild, they're more like OBTs.
No way! that defensive kind of behavior. Huh?
Extremely defensive. They're not as fast, but definitely defensive. Venom dripping every time you poke them.
Oh, wow. So you work with those? I mean, have you been able to produce anything?
No, I don't work with them.
No.
I've seen them in the wild, but that's just another whole project I don't want to get into yet.
Yeah. They sound cool, though.
I have my hands full with the current ones I have.
So right now, where you're talking to me, behind you, I can see some tarantulas and stuff like that. Like, are you in your house or are you at your breeding facility?
So this is my house. Those are just like overflow tarantulas that we have. This is my wife's office, which is also the quietest spot in our house. the dogs are locked up in my bedroom right now. Nice. So they don't bark during our interview. But yeah, those are just like little slings. I think those are Mershalis or Darlinis that we produced. Uh-huh. And also crested geckos up there in the taller bins.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you work with a lot more than just... you know, a native United States species. You're breeding all kinds of different species.
Yeah. So my personal collection of breeding spiders is about 600 females. I don't even know how many males. And we're working with about 70 species. So lots of redundancy in our projects.
Yeah. You keep saying we, So who are you, I mean, are you just, is it just a, like a collective we, or are do you people that are like on a team with you?
I should explain this a little bit better. Yeah. But, we is me and my wife. My wife bought out my old business partner 2 years ago. And so she owns 45% of the company.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would assume so. I don't know. Working with your wife could be challenging sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, you know, it was the best thing we ever decided to do. I was doing micro wilderness all by myself. When I had a business partner back in 2019, I was doing all the work and he was just injecting money into the business. And that was just a little overwhelming. Natasha and I actually split the workload now.
Very cool. Yeah. I the reason I asked is because a lot of times, like when I'm making videos or stuff like that, I will say like we or they or something like that. And then people leave comments about, you know, like one information about, you know, like, well, they'll start using we. Like, you guys are awesome. I'm like, you guys, it's just me. And then I'm like, that's probably my fault. Cause I say like, you know, sometimes I refer to myself in a plural. So I was just wondering if you're doing the same thing.
Oh, for sure. No, I may be the face of micro wilderness, but Natasha does a lot. If any of our customers hit us up, she does all the customer service. She does all the packing. Yeah. And she does a lot of the feedings as well. So she takes a lot off of my plate, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't want to like, I don't want you to give away any trade secrets or anything like that. But
sure.
I get messages a lot from people that assume just because I make YouTube videos and I have a lot of tarantulas that I'm selling tarantulas. And you know, in those instances, I recommend, you know, I try to forward them to people like you. I'm like, you know, I don't breed, I don't deal, I don't sell anything that's live, but, you know, Micro Wilderness does, you know, check out their website, hit them up. And the main reason, you know, like when I had this large collection and was essentially trying to figure out some way to like, not so much monetize it, but I was like, I just want the hobby to pay for itself. Mm-hmm. And the first, you know, I think is happens with everybody that ends up, you know, when they get to the point they have 100 tarantulas, they're like, I'll just start breeding and selling, and that will essentially pay for the hobby and maybe right. make a little bit of extra money. And you see this a lot. These, you know, people get excited. They're very passionate. They've got a large collection. They start breeding. They open up, you know, they get a website. They incorporate their business maybe, or, you know, they start, you know, advertising, announcing, I'm a tarantula dealer and sure. I'm a breeder. You know, and I want your business. And then maybe 6 months or a year later, they fold, you know, they sell out or they close down because they're just overwhelmed. And, you know, I had watched that for years. And when I was like, initially the first thing was like the easiest, you know, these adults are selling for hundreds of dollars, but the slings are only $10. So I could buy these slings and, you know, like as an investment, grow them up, pair them, sell them, make the money back. It may take years, but, you know, it's so like, that was the easiest, most obvious way to kind of help the, you know, the hobby to pay for itself. But I had seen this so much that I was like, that's a lot of work. And, you know, then obviously it's very stressful and it has a high turnover. But you've been doing this for a while. So, you know, and just like, I just was wondering maybe you could give people that maybe considering breeding and selling tarantulas an idea of like what it's actually like the amount of time and work that goes into it.
I mean, you explained a lot of it. My story is very similar. Like, micro wilderness started off as my hobby and still is my hobby. But, I had to kind of cater or like create a career and lifestyle, to cater to this, you know? But, I don't know. Like, I think the most important part about doing what I do is just really loving these animals because, it's not all about the cash. It's, there's a lot of work that goes into this. You know, I've lost like my whole social group because of what I do, because I'm constantly working. It's a 7 day a week job.
Yeah.
So I think you just have to be persistent and just, if you want to do this as, like as a professional, or be in the professional space with, spiders, you just have to keep trucking even when it gets hard.
You mentioned that, you know, it can take weeks or I'm sorry. It's a 7 day a week job. So how much time do you spend feeding tarantulas, like just feeding?
It takes three people to feed my whole collection and the stock. And it takes a whole week.
So you're feeding every single day. You just kind of have like a rotation.
Yes. So, we feed almost every single day and it takes on average 8 days for us to get from one spider to every single spider back to that same spider.
Gotcha. And you also have, I assume, you know, as they grow, you have to rehouse them. Like, I mean, how do you handle
that?
Oh,
yeah. Oh, it's just one of those things where when we see a spider is getting a little too cramped, we just, you know, put it in a bigger enclosure. And that we're pretty diligent on that. So just if one of our staff members sees that, they'll just do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been to at least one other tarantula dealer, you know, and like got to see the behind the scenes stuff, you know, like where they have everything stored and, you know, a team of people feeding and rehousing and unboxing and, you know, like when they get an import or something like that. And,
for sure.
You know, it seems like a whole lot of work. And I think that, you know, maybe sometimes people have, you know, 50 or 100 spiders and they've got their routine down and they're like, this is easy. I got this down. I can do this. But when you start breeding and selling, you got to hold some stocks. So like, just like, you know, a rough estimate, how many like spiderlings would you say you have at any one time? Just so you have like stock for your website.
So just in the 2 months that have passed, we've produced about 10,000 tarantulas. Oh, wow. we have about 15,000 in stock right now. We do like wholesale a bunch of them out to other dealers. The only ones we don't wholesale out are the Fauna Pelmas.
So that's a lot of mouths to feed.
It is. It is. We order 6,000 crickets a week. Wow. Yeah.
So like, do you ever like have work? Like, you know, one thing you see a lot of people worry about is something bad happened, you know, like an infestation of ants or, you know, mites taking over enclosures. Like, how do you mitigate those types of risks?
Well, that one's difficult. For ants, my current facility looks like Pablo Escobar sneezed all over it because there's diatomaceous earth everywhere just as an ant prevention.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a powder that just keeps ants away.
Gotcha.
For mites, I mean, like here in Southern Cali, our air is really dry, so we're constantly having to water everything. So we don't really have the like a moisture problem where the mites can really grow. Gotcha. But yeah, the ants are a bad thing for us. Also, another thing is the rolling blackouts that LA experiences. Oh,
yeah.
Because we have these nasty heat waves. And so we're trying to figure out processes for that right now too.
Yeah. Yeah, I know we were dealing with some power outages here lately. And it seems like every time that happens, you know, for whatever reason, the power grid here is not good. So we don't have like rolling blackouts. But it sometimes it feels like if it rains and the wind blows too hard, we just don't have power for a day until they get hooked back up. So we've been really thinking about getting one of those generators that hooks up the natural gas that just automatically kicks on.
Yeah, you know, I kind of want to get a generator too, but LA gas prices are high right now.
I can imagine. It seems everything in California is really high right now.
$7 a gallon is killing us, man.
Including the people.
Oh yeah, I know.
it was a little bit of a culture shock. It's changed. I mean, this was years ago, but we flew out. As soon as we left LAX, the first thing we saw was a billboard for a medicinal marijuana facility. I was like, "They're just openly selling weed out here. It's a felony in West Virginia." But it's changed.
Oh man, it's a lifestyle here. Yeah,
it's like everywhere we went, there were billboards with pot leaves on it. Or I wanted to get a vape. Like a, you know, nicotine vape, and I walked. Sure. I don't remember the name of the store, but I walked in there thinking it was like a little tobacco outlet, and no, it was just all marijuana. Like, this is not the right place.
Yeah, no, it seems like there's one in every corner in LA.
Yeah, but that's changed here now it's legal medicinally, and there's you know doctor's offices and little dispensaries popping up. So yeah, getting used to it now, but like for a while, it was just like, this is so wild. But yeah, you know, one question I get a lot, especially anytime I post a video of my collection, you know, like behind me, like on TikTok or something, there's always some smart ass in the comments that are like, well, what are you going to do if there's an earthquake? And it's like, I live in the Ohio Valley of West Virginia on the foothills of the Appalachians. There are very rarely any earthquakes here. And if there is an earthquake, it's so weak, you could barely even notice it. You know, it's like you see the news like, hey, we had an earthquake today at 3:00. And it's like, I didn't even notice. I heard like maybe some plates jig. I just figured a big heavy car came driving by or something. But California, that's a real issue. It's a real threat. Like, do you have to take steps to protect all your tarantulas?
I figured if we have another Northridge quake, it's just going to be having to deal with the escapees, you know? we have, in my facility where I rent a house for my tarantulas, we have these types of racks, and we just have the bungee cords across in case it knocks over, but it's not much of a preventative measure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, somebody mentioned earthquake straps or something like that to keep things from falling off.
Straps. Yeah, like besides like bolting these racks to the wall, I can't really think of anything else, you know?
Yeah. I mean, is that something you lose sleep over, though? Like you're worried that out of nowhere there'll be an earthquake that is just strong enough to shake the shelves enough where enclosures start falling?
Oh, of course. That would be my worst nightmare to come home to, you know, thousands of tarantulas running around. But, you know, it's where I live and where I choose to live. So it's one of those things that I have to deal with.
Right. I mean, just like if you lived in Florida, you'd be dealing with hurricanes or...
Exactly.
Yeah. And my wife...
Yeah, at least it's not flooding.
Yeah. My wife sent me I don't know. She got on one this morning and has convinced herself that she wants to live in Louisiana. Like, I don't know, maybe 45 minutes. I don't even know which direction, but outside of New Orleans. And she had all these reasons and just like sending me all these links and pictures and like, this would be a great place for us to move in a couple of years. And all I could think about is like, yeah, but they get hurricanes. I don't want to deal
with
that.
No joke. Yeah. One of the worst ones in our history was there.
Yeah. I was like, I moved to Daytona Beach, Florida back in like 2000 something, early 2000s. And I remember I moved to Daytona Beach and I was dating this girl and we moved out there and her dad lived down there. And that's like why we went and visited him and like, this is paradise. This is amazing. I want to live here. And we packed up everything. Like, I think we visited him in like February and we moved there in like April or May, like right at the beginning of hurricane season. And that was like one of the worries I expressed was like, you know, I don't know what to do with a hurricane. I don't want to deal with a hurricane. He's like, there hasn't been a hurricane in Daytona Beach in 40 years. Like, you're going to be fine. And then like 2 months later, we had like four hurricanes. And
oh,
one of them was
gosh.
Hurricane Charlie came through and just like, we didn't have power in like August for 2 weeks. It was just like,
oh no,
this is miserable. Why did I do this? And then it was like every year after that, it might not be like a direct hit where the eye goes, you know, right over our house. But, you know, that first year we had two eye wall, you know, the eye came over where we were staying. And then every year after that, we would have really high winds and power outages. Right. And I was just like, this is like, I don't want to live here anymore. I don't want to deal with hurricanes.
How long were you there for?
8 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it was beautiful. I love being by the beach, even though I rarely went to the beach because I'm a ginger. So it's like, I don't want to get sunburned. But I like going down there and watching the sunset or, you know, going down there at night. It was just laid back. I like that aspect. Most businesses didn't open until 10 a.m. instead of, you know, 9 a.m. And I enjoyed a lot of the aspects of it, but I didn't like the mosquitoes. I didn't like the heat and humidity and I didn't like the hurricanes. And it finally was just like, and I had a good job and then I lost that job. And it was like, I don't see any reason to stay here. Like it's miserable. So we moved back to West Virginia, where there were seasons because I missed winter. I missed snow. Mm-hmm. I missed fall. And so it was, I like that. But you know, she was like, you lived, like, you know how to deal with hurricanes. You lived through them. And I'm like, yeah, but I chose not to do that anymore. I don't want to move back into the path of hurricanes. Like, but now this time we're in a swamp, or you know. So, yeah, I don't know about that.
That's crazy. You know, I've actually never experienced true seasons. I've always been in the Southwest United States,
yeah.
So we only have a dry season and a wet season.
Yeah, that's why I can never. One of the many reasons I can never live in California, mainly just the cost of living. Like, I actually was going to go to college, and I got accepted in. It was, I can't remember the name of the school now. It was one of those universities in San Diego. And I was really stoked and then was looking at the price of an apartment. And this is back in like 99. And at that point, it was like $2,500 a month for a one bedroom.
Oh, gosh. Like,
where I lived in Huntington, West Virginia, I could go to Marshall and not have to pay any tuition for the most part. Like, it was all just covered in grants and in-state tuition. And you could get an apartment there, one bedroom for $400. I'm like,
oh yeah, that's a no-brainer.
But I wanted to get out of town, so I ended up going to Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Oh, nice.
Which was they, you know, if you like winter, that's the place to go. Really hot in the summer and really cold in the winter, but it was nice. It was flat, good people, and you know, I got in my fair share of trouble out there, but So I ended up, yeah, that's the story of my life. I go somewhere. I enjoy it. I stay there for a few, you know, 5-6 years. And then it's like, all right, we're going to go back to West Virginia where I feel safe.
So you were from West Virginia originally?
Yeah. Yeah. I grew up in Huntington, cool. West Virginia, and went to school in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and then retreated back to West Virginia, and then moved down to Daytona Beach and retreated back to West Virginia. And in between there, I went to Kodiak, Alaska for a few months. Like, got there, it was snowing, stayed through the summer, loved it, started snowing again. It's like, all right, time to go back to the lower 48.
Cool, man.
Yeah, but yeah, all roads lead back to West Virginia. And where I would really like to go is Arizona. Like, we went there on a honeymoon. I loved it. And I'm like, you know, let's not do Louisiana. Let's do Arizona. But she's kind of this, she really likes New Orleans. Like, that's her favorite place. So
we have a job, man. We got to convince our wives to move there because my wife is not biting. I love Arizona more than any other state.
Yeah, I got so jealous when Peter and Jesse from Shapes of Nature ditched Oregon and moved down to Arizona.
Oh, man.
They got that nice little ranch. Well, what is it called? I feel terrible now. It's like a little bed bug and breakfast. They take people out on tours.
That's so cute.
Sky Island Adventures. That's what it's called. Yeah.
Oh, that area is amazing too.
Yeah. Yeah. It sucked. I was, he invited me out when they first moved down there and got everything set up and was like, you know, we were not technically open for business yet, but we'd love to have you out, stay in the guest house. You know, it's where they do like the little bed and breakfast. He makes all the meals and stuff for you. And they pick you up at the Tucson airport, drive you out to their property, get you set up, provide the food, the lodging, all that. And then they'll take you out like during the day, go herping, looking for inverts. And then they'll take you out at night and set up like the backlights and all that stuff to attract bugs. And I was like, yeah, that's amazing. I'm definitely going to do that.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
And then COVID hit and it's like, I can't fly anywhere, so I'm not going to be able to do that. So I'm really looking forward to get out there, but they're like open now. I had reached out to them not long ago talking about them. Like, we're booked up. opened up
damn.
The books.
That's something I want to check out for sure. So it's called Bed Bug and Breakfast.
No, it's called Sky Island Adventures.
Sky Island Adventures.
And I think that they kind of like describe it that way. It's a bed bug and breakfast facility.
That's so amazing.
There's not bed bugs, but you know, they've got beds. They take you out to see bugs and they serve you breakfast.
Oh gosh, that sounds like a dream.
Yeah, Aquarimax got to go out there, but he's like in Utah, so it was not very far for him.
Right,
it was a lot easier. And I was watching his videos and I was like, that looks so cool. I really want to go out there. But it's like it's one of the things I'm struggling with, and I'm sure you probably have some similar struggles maybe within your relationship. I don't know. You can tell me, but you know, I'm decided to focus on videos. So, you know, part of what I'm, you know, a lot of it I can do right here in the basement. Like, you know, I'm talking to you right now, we're recording some content, but some of the stuff I want to do is, you know, go out to Texas and Arizona and Colorado and Utah and California and like film these tarantulas in their natural environment. And I want to get out of the country, you know, like maybe go to Mexico or South America, Central America, maybe even one day somewhere like Thailand or something, you know, like we'll build up to that, but start with like the Southwest and then kind of move south, maybe even like, you know, go to Peru or Puerto Rico or, you know, just somewhere with some of their, you know, tarantulas are and see them in the wild. And, but beyond that, just go into expos or go into like, you know, it'd be cool to come out and see your breeding facility sometime or,
that'd be awesome.
Got invited to go, check out Houston Frogs. They got a cool laboratory and breeding facility. And, you know, so I get these invites all the time. And it's the dilemma is, you know, my wife's like my best friend and, you know, we enjoy traveling together and hiking and getting out in nature.
Sure.
And for me to be like, well, you got to stay here with the kids because my work was just going to require me to go to Costa Rica and like hike through the jungles. Like she would be extremely jealous. Like she wants to go and do that with me, you know? But so and then I have to like, I either piss her off or I try to work it out so she can take time off work and we can find someone to watch the kids and go do that kind of stuff. So it's like, there's all these cool things that I want to do, but I want to use that opportunity for that experience to, you know, bring my wife along with me.
For sure.
And you know, and your wife, you guys are partners, but I mean, do you run into those kind of issues at all?
I mean, she is my best friend as well. So obviously I want her, you know, tagging along all the time, but also we got thousands of animals. So, you know, anytime one of us takes off, one of us has to stay behind. And just like handle the, you know, just the business and all the feedings and whatnot. So when I go out to like Arizona or Texas, it's usually just me and a group of other people, and Natasha's like running the business.
Yeah. Does she ever leave you behind?
So Natasha, when she travels out, it's usually for just pleasure for her. I always handle all like the spider stuff or the micro wilderness stuff for travel. Natasha's more of the behind the scenes stuff. So yeah, when she goes out, it's, you know, for a weekend with Vegas with the friends or, you know, the Hamptons.
Fancy. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would like one day to be in a situation similar to yours where like she can just quit her job and it worked for me, I guess. Like I tease her that a lot. I'm like, you know, I could really use an assistant, somebody to like respond to emails and talk to the public. Cause you know, that's like where I struggle the most is just interacting with other, like you and I are having a good conversation right now, but
for sure.
You know, but we, you know, we've talked for a while, but a lot of times somebody leaves a comment or sends me an email. I guess it's just my personality. If it's even the slightest bit critical, then like I get really defensive and can very easily say something kind of rude. And they're like, whoa, dude, I didn't mean it like that. I'm like, I'm sorry. That was my perception. I just assume everybody's being a dick to me. So for whatever reason. But she's really good.
I do get defensive online as well. Cause you know, there's always haters. You could be doing the best thing in the world and someone's going to say some, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I let it blow over my head.
A lot of times I'll say something and I'll perceive it as being rude. And they may even have meant it to be kind of rude and condescending or whatever. But they don't, they just assume, you know, you don't read those comments. So when I respond to it, they're just like, whoa, I didn't even know. I love you, man. I didn't mean that. Like, all right. But she's, I mean, like her job right now, she's kind of like public relations. You know, she goes out for, you know, the organization she works for and talks to the public and talks to kids, and you know, she's really good at like interacting with people. And so I'm like, you know, it would be great if you could like handle emails and comments and reach out to businesses and do that kind of talking.
Honestly, I'd be so lost without Natasha right now. Cause she handles all the, like, just like the customer stuff. So
yeah.
I can't be, you know, the head of this company and like running the customer interactions anymore.
Right.
Just because it's gotten so big, you know, like we have like 40 people hitting us up every single day.
Wow. That's pretty wild. Yeah. That's, I remember when you, I mean, you started, you said, was it like 2019? And when did Micro Wilderness officially become a business?
Can you repeat that, Richard? You broke up a bit.
I'm sorry. I was asking like, when did Micro Wilderness officially become a business?
Okay. So, the actual formulation of Micro Wilderness was 2016. So we're 6 years old now. But it was like super slow and small back then. I was just a backyard breeder, just doing VersaColors and LPs and stuff. It was more about like trying to get this YouTube project started, which never happened, with Chung Chow at the Water Box. I don't know if you know him. He's a great aquarium channel on YouTube. But we tried to do this whole like exotic animal channel on the side where we were going to co-host this thing. And I fell upon some VersaColors, like a half sack of VersaColors I traded for. I started selling them and I was like, oh, that was pretty good cash for, you know, for what that was. Let me try doing this a bit more. I started breeding VersaColors, bred a sack, made a bit of cash. Fell in love with the whole process of breeding tarantulas and then just started doing that commercially on top of just the Afana Pelma stuff. I was just doing it on the side.
Yeah. I was just trying to remember when I first kind of became aware of you and what you're doing.
So I reached out to you, like Tarantula Cat and like Deadly Tarantula Girl and like all the YouTubers around 2018.
Okay.
And that's when things got really big for us that year. That's when I got a business partner, Jonathan Dice, at the time. He injected a bunch of cash into the growth of the business. We actually incorporated 2018. So it went from just like a hobbyist breeder situation to, oh my gosh, we have 200 tarantula females breeding now.
Yeah.
and that first year of breeding, we actually pulled like 60 egg sacks. I was overwhelmed, but you know, we grew into it pretty easily. You know, we just started hiring people to help. that year, there was a slowdown right before the COVID. That was like pre-COVID, like 2019. There was a slowdown during the holiday sales, and my business partner actually gave me the opportunity to buy him out at that point. At that point, yeah, so my wife bought him out, got his share of the business. COVID hit, and that's when we really blew up because all the stimulus checks started happening, and then you started blasting us out on YouTube. Kat did as well. I started becoming more vocal about the company on social media. And from there, it was history. We just started growing more and more and more, and it hasn't stopped.
Yeah. So just on my own curiosity, I guess, getting, you know, like having YouTubers or content creators advertise your business. I mean, do you find that to be helpful, like profitable? Is it a good investment?
I think so. It was definitely a huge boon for us because, you guys have the actual audience of hobbyists. having, you know, the Tarantula Collective say a positive thing about Micro Wilderness, it does get heard, you know? So we do appreciate the blast outs and people do listen to those.
Yeah. Yeah. I always like kind of, it just always like for me, sometimes it's weird doing integrated ads because it's like, somebody, you know, pays me to advertise their business in a video.
For sure.
And I only do that if like I trust them. You know what I mean? Like I don't want to. Like,
right.
And sometimes I've made recommendations that, you know, a couple years later, I'm like, oh man, I kind of regret that because they were cool at the time, but then they got shady or I learned more about them and we're like, yeah, I'm not going to do that anymore. You know, cause I just kind of worry about my own personal reputation. I want people to trust me. And you were one of the ones I was like, I like Nate. He seems like a good, solid guy. I like what he's doing. And it was like, it was you and Tarantula Cribs, I think, kind of, I don't want to say got me and Tarantula Cat together, but got us on speaking terms.
We had
some stuff go down. Like we didn't have beef, but our friends had beef. And it was like, we kind of got grouped into two different sides of the hobby.
I've heard the drama from your other podcast.
Yeah. But I think it was because you were reaching out to both of us and we were both interacting with you and we were both interacting with Tarantula Cribs. And she was like, if they're working with them and they're working with me, like maybe, you know, and she sent me a message on Twitter or something like that. And it was like, why are we beefing? And I'm like, we're not beefing. We're just not speaking to each other. I just don't want to deal with drama. And she's like, I don't want to deal with drama either. She's like, Nate says you're a good guy and you know, Mo says you're a good guy. I'm like, yeah, they say the same thing about you, but they say you're a good lady and then we became friends. And so
honestly, you guys are my favorite content creators, and that's why I keep hitting you guys up for those integrated ads.
Well, we definitely appreciate it. And
yeah, for
you know,
sure.
So I just want to say thanks for, you know, playing your part and getting me a good friend in Tarantula Cat.
Yeah. And, you know, me and Kat also have talked about is, you know, I keep you guys in mind too. I'll never embarrass you guys. So, you guys vouching for me means a big, means a lot to me, you know? You know, I'll never do anything embarrassing or to ever embarrass you guys too.
Appreciate that. Yeah. And that was like the only, when I first started running ads for you, and really kind of promoting Micro Wilderness, there was a little bit of pushback from people that were, you know, being like, you're always saying, don't buy captive bred tarantulas, but this guy is selling captive bred tarantulas. And like, I kind of looked into that, talked to Kat, and we discussed that a lot. And we're like,
yeah,
it's not really captive bred. You know, he's collecting wild tarantulas.
But oh yeah. The wild cause. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. So yeah. So it was, and that's usually something that people, if they ever bring up, turns into a kind of a long conversation about, you know, what's ethical and what's not, you know, what's exploitative and what's harmful. So how do you kind of like draw that line or, you know, ethically determine what's good to wild collect and what's not? And I mean, you mentioned that you reintroduce the spiderling and stuff back in there, but
sure.
You know, if I get those comments, I'm sure maybe you have received some.
Oh yeah. It's the most controversial part of my business actually.
Yeah.
But you know, as for ethical lines, you know, I never take more than what I need. I usually just collect for breeding purposes. So I really don't see a problem with that because it's not like I'm mass collecting wild tarantulas and selling them on my website. That's just definitely not what happens. Like even the Arizona blondes on my website, I actually buy from vendors in Arizona.
Yeah, I think that's some of the misconceptions that people have.
Yeah.
You know, they see that you've got maybe some adult tarantulas on there and they just assume, just based on your posts, like, well, if he's collecting them in the wild to breed in captivity,
right,
that he's probably also collecting them just to sell. Like, you know, some people
right.
have been known to do.
I'm not going to lie. Like, you know, I have sold wild caught specimens, but those are usually like things I've caught that were too young to breed or not receptive to breeding, or like, you know, just had an egg sac and won't go for another 2 years.
Yeah.
So but things always, that just wouldn't sit.
Right. But just from my own memory, looking at your website, you usually notate that though, right? You're not trying to pass off wild caught as captive bred or something.
Correct, correct. And, you know, I have an open like 9 on my website or like a chat box.
Yeah.
And so people usually ask about that, and Natasha will talk to them about whether something's wild-caught or captive-bred. We don't have very much wild-caught stuff, just some of the bigger Afanopelma females on our website. Yeah, nothing else really. Brachys are all captive-bred from Mexico. Everything else imported from Europe.
Yeah. You know, now that you bring that up, that was something else I wanted to talk about, was you had some Brachypelmas for a while on your website. Mm-hmm. I think you even maybe sent me some.
Yes.
You sent me like a box of red tarantulas, if I'm remembering correctly.
Oh, yeah.
And
the erotums.
Yeah. And that was like when I feel like that whole Mexican import-export thing was really taking off and getting popular, because mm-hmm. they had that kind of program where they do essentially similar to what you do. They go out and they capture, you know, these adult tarantulas in the wild, and they bring them into a facility and they breed them. And then they like kind of split the egg sac, where some of them are reintroduced into the wild and some
right.
are certified to be exported to North America, whether it's, you know, the US or Canada, for selling mm-hmm. the pet trade. And when they do that, they have some kind of like, they have like a serial number or certification number or something like that.
Each animal is serialized.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that Mexican program is actually my biggest inspiration to my hobby.
I was just hoping maybe you could kind of explain that, because I've tried explaining it, you know, in a video or just in conversations with people. And it's like, you know, I read a paper that was published, and I don't even know how much of it's true, but you have like some direct interaction and experience
for sure.
with people. So maybe you could kind of just explain to the listeners what that program's like and how it works.
So that program's headed by a school in Mexico. Let me take this slowly, because I'm trying to take every detail of it. But
sure.
All right. So that it's the university. They breed tarantulas that they've caught in certain like locales of Mexico. And I don't know if it's half, but they do re-release a lot of those brachys. And it's because they were over-collected in the past and they were endangered.
Mm-hmm.
The US stuff and the Canada stuff that's brought in is all captive bred. The Mexican government doesn't allow wild caught specimens to be shipped over to the US. So, those serial numbers, you could actually look up on their database, and it'll tell you a complete like history of when they were bred, or when they were born, and just like, just various life histories about them.
So they've got, you know, just kind of a lot of the pertinent information.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. If they've been bred and when they were produced and whatnot.
Okay. And like, does that, so when then, say, we're just speaking hypothetically, I guess, you order an import from those, that facility or whatever, then they send sure. you them. Like, how is the certification, like each spiderling has like a number printed on the bottle, or?
So, yeah, it's each spiderling or, you know, sub-adult tarantula, yeah. adult tarantula will have a container, and it will have an individual serial number on there. And those serial numbers are attached to the CITES permits, which are endangered animal permits that come along with these animals as we import them.
Gotcha.
So the process to import these animals isn't easy. It takes months for me just paying the deposit for these animals. There's a lot of paperwork that goes in both on the U.S. Government side and the Mexican side, especially the Mexican side, for permits called CITES, which is like a convention for international trade of exotic specimens.
Uh-huh.
And they... Yeah, like that process in getting that paperwork approved, just for some reason on that side, just takes 2-3 months. I've had one set of paperwork take 6 months to pass once.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's a lot of money being hung up, you know?
Yeah. As we were talking right now, my air conditioner kicked on. And I was like, what? I had that set to 80. And I checked. I was like, it is 80 degrees in my house right now. We'll just let it run. So, you know, if you can hear it in the background, I apologize. But, you know, before I started making videos and, you know, we talked earlier, I was like trying to think of ways to make, you know, money or, you know, just kind of, you know, cover the cost of the hobby. And I was really into, I mean, I kind of still am, but at the time I was like really into cryptocurrency and especially Ethereum. And that was one of the ideas I had was kind of doing like tarantula coins on the Ethereum blockchain, where if you got a tarantula that was capped at bread, you could, they could like generate a coin that was tied to that specific species. So it was, you know, non-fungible. And then if, you know, you, so say you bred, you know, a fauna pelmas, you could, you know, assign on a blockchain, like a certificate or whatever, to each one of those slings. So when you sold the sling, then you could also transfer that token. And then that person would have like, you know, certifiable, you know, proof that it can be, you know, really changed at all, that this was a captive bred specimen. And then if they end up selling that or breeding it, you know, it would essentially create like a blockchain, like a ledger of where this species originated from and what it's been bred with. And, you know, so you could like sell a spiderling that was, you know, you could guarantee this is captive bred from a line of captive breds. And you can view it on the blockchain and see where it came from. And I mean, they do that kind of stuff with, you know, a lot of food and stuff like that, you know, that, that's been transferred around the world, you know, different ways to kind of track that and know where it is that you're getting it from and all that, you know, it, and, you know, it's just a lot of cool information that can be saved on the blockchain. And I just thought that would be really cool with tarantulas. And you know, so that not only would, could you guarantee that this is captive bred or was ethically sourced, but also when it comes to breeding, you could like, you know, look at your lineage and then the lineage of the tarantula you're thinking of breeding and, you know, make sure you're, you know, they're not like closely related or, you know, you need a lot of like crazy inbreeding or stuff going on and guarantee that it's the species that people say it is. And it just seemed like it would be beneficial, but it's also, that's also a lot of work and I'm not a computer science genius. So I was like, I don't even know how to do this. This is like an idea I had. But then at the time, you know, again, this is years and years ago. It didn't seem like people would care. Like, you know what I mean? Like they just want to buy their tarantula, keep it. They don't really care about how they got it or where it came from or anything like that. But that's changed, especially like with this whole Mexican thing and because of CITES regulations and people, they don't, you know, for the most part, I mean, I'm not speaking universally, but most people that are like, you know, responsible keepers, they don't want to buy a tarantula that was just ripped out of the jungles of Brazil or something and in their room. And not just because that's, you know, it's bad for the wild specimens in the native locations, but in my experience, it also seems that keeping a captive bred tarantula in, I'm sorry, a wild caught tarantula in captivity poses a lot of problems. Like they're just not adapted to that. And I think that a lot of these, you know, like the T. celadonia are, they're a very fragile species and I have no scientific evidence to back this up, no degrees or anything like that. But my gut instinct is they're still very freshly, even if they're captive bred, it, not that many generations ago, we're living in the wild, you know, and through natural selection, I guess, you know, you breed a tarantula, like you get two wild specimens, you breed them and you have captive bred babies. Some of them are going to be, I don't even know the right word, like they're just more adept to a wild kind of environment and they don't thrive in captivity. So the wild, the ones that are more, you know, they'll die off young and the only ones that survive are the ones that, you know, are a little more adept to living in captivity. And then those are bred and the same thing happens. And, you know, and after multiple generations, you've kind of narrowed it down to the ones we're breeding are more adept to live in captivity. So they're a lot easier. And I feel like maybe that's part of the reason Celadonia is so difficult to keep in captivity because they just haven't been bred enough generations to kind of like make the bloodlines more, I could be talking to my ass, dude. I don't know if there's anything to that, but, I mean, you're a breeder. Is there anything to that?
I think that's part of it, but also it all depends on the species. Cause like, let's go back to the brachypelmas. Those are extremely hardy slings, you know? Like even the first generation captives that I get from Mexico, they usually like they have like a 90% success rate. Okay. So Yeah, so it's nothing like I have some experience with the Celadonia, and yes, they are very fragile because I killed all five of mine.
It's heartbreaking, isn't it?
Oh, man. I think it was just like experimenting with different parameters, and also getting to every animal once every 8 days just wasn't enough for that animal, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that was somebody sent me one, and I didn't ask for it. I didn't really want it, mainly because it was like, they're just high maintenance. And,
yes,
you know, I was like, I'm not comfortable with that. I was like, maybe if somebody had a juvenile or an adult at some point that they wanted to gift me, I could be interested. But like, I can't afford to buy one at the prices they are right now.
Yeah, correct.
But then, you know, they sent it to me in a pack, like a box of a bunch of other tarantulas for an unboxing. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. And then it wasn't a week, you know, and they sent the enclosure, they sent everything, like information on how to do it. And I followed it letter by letter, but it still ended up dying. And they're just like, yeah, a lot of them do still die. And I'm just like, jeez, that sucks. Like, I couldn't imagine if I dropped $600 on a sling that died, you know, within a month.
I know.
Especially if you're doing everything right, or at least what you think is right, but you just haven't been in the hobby yet long enough, I think, for us to really have their husbandry down perfectly in captivity. So a lot of it's still kind of trial and error. But they're also very fragile. My hope is that as they are bred, you know, the ones that survive in captivity are bred, and the one they're
get hardier.
You know,
sure.
Yeah, they'll definitely get more acclimated to it. But again, that's just an instinctual feeling that I have. It's based in, you know, I can't say that that's fact or has any scientific basis at all. But you know, but tying back to what I was originally discussing, it seemed like having some kind of certification number, whether it's on the blockchain or it's just issued from, you know, government or some kind of regulating body, would be beneficial for the hobby, as far as, you know, especially with all of the different Lacey Act laws and CITES and stuff
for
like
sure.
that are going on, that it would be, you know, kind of like license, like I have sometimes dogs have a paperwork that comes with them, you know, for purebred, that it would be beneficial. For like, if I bought a tarantula, maybe you have to pay a little bit more, but I know that this tarantula is paperwork that's proven that it's purebred, that it wasn't some guy in a basement, you know, some guy like me mixing species, you know, because he didn't know any better. They're mixing Smithy and Hamori and creating some weird hobby breed, or mixing different species of Postlotheria and selling them, you know. So as a breeder, is that something that you would be interested in or could see happening in the future? Or is that just like, nobody cares?
So not only is it interested, but I didn't want to tease into it too much, but we are working on some sort of token for the blockchain.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I don't want to say too much right now because it's in the beginning stages, but yes, it's very similar to what we were just talking about.
Very cool. And I won't take any credit for your idea because I'm sure we had them. But I mean, that's a cool thing about blockchain. Like when I first saw that, the prices dipped, I still think the technology is very exciting.
I think like moving forward with this idea, it's when you talked about like, you know, monetizing ideas with this, I think that this could be an extra little thing with the spider that, you know, can make it more valuable or make it cooler, you know?
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I saw them doing that with, or they were talking about, I mean, this, you know, when Ethereum was that was like one of the use cases, like why this has value. It's not just like made money. It's the fact that, you know, like the title to your house or to your car or something like that, instead of just being a piece of printed paper you keep in a safe, it could be securely, you know, on the blockchain and transferred and non-fungible. Like you can't make changes to it, you know, and counterfeit it or anything like that. So it's like, you know, it is a ledger that's indisputable that can be moved along and things can be added to it, but not subtracted from it, you know?
Correct.
So I was like, this would, like that technology, it's great for property. It's great for, you know, you get a college degree instead of getting a diploma, you can print out, you know, on your computer and make fake and hang on the wall. It would be issued on the blockchain. I was like, if they're going to do that for college degrees, if they're going to do that for, you know, property titles and stuff like that, they should be able to do that for animals. And yeah, you know,
right. And there's a particular crypto that we're looking at for this too. I don't know if you're familiar with Solana.
I'm not familiar with that one. I thought you were going to say Cardano or something.
It's similar, but you know, it has, do you know what gas fees are?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just very low gas fees, very instant type transfer rather than the, you know, primitive Ethereum chain.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really big into crypto for many years, you know, when Ethereum first came out and Cardano and Neo and all those. And, you know, pretty much since, I would say 2018, 2019, like when I started focusing more on YouTube and stuff. I stopped following the crypto markets as much. Like for a while there, I was day trading every day and margin trading and all kinds of essentially gambling.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. In 2018, I lost it all, man.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was that drop.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was like the whole way up, I took, you know, $5,000 and, you know, probably turned it into $50,000.
Oh, wow.
And then it was like, you know, I just thought I was a genius, but it was pretty much like I could just buy something at a dip and then just wait a couple of days and it would like, you know, 2X and then I would sell. And it's like where I was working, you know, we had customers coming in, but it was usually one at a time and, you know, there'd be 10, for 15. Sure. So we like, and we were both, we just had, you know, dual monitors and one of them was just, you know, crypto. And, you know, just watching the charts and just buying and selling and, you know, just kind of, it was just that crazy. Like it would spike up and we'd sell it and then it would sell off and then we'd buy back into the dip and, you know, doing a lot of the margins. So we're like, you know, 3 times or 5 times are what we actually had. And, but then, yeah, that dip happened and I was actually, I was long Ethereum at the time. I probably had about, I think it was like, I mean, at the time, Ethereum was probably only like $400, less than that. I mean, now it's like, I mean, where it peaked at like 20, or I don't even remember what, like $5,000 or something. I don't know. But it was much cheaper than it was. But I had, I think I had like a 5X margin. So we'll say I had like 100 Ethereum coins, but I was actually trading 500 and waiting for it. I bought it low and it kept, I was thinking as soon as it goes up, I'm going to sell it, make a nice little profit. But it kept going down and kept going down and kept going down. And then I would get like a margin call. So I would deposit more. I'm like, it's got to go back up. It's eventually going to go back up. And it just kept going down.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, I mean, I'm not really active in crypto now, but we're digressing about crypto. But okay. Yeah, I'm not really into crypto now, but I heard that there's kind of a winter storm on that right now.
Yeah. It's definitely dipped back down. So, and that's like really the only time when it starts going up real high or when it starts going down real low is the only time I start paying attention again.
Yeah, but, same.
But I learned my lesson. I was like, all right, I don't have time to focus on this. And our business was suffering because of it because we're spending so much time day trading. And so we just decided, like, I just, you know, I cleared out the, lost some money. But it's still like, even after all the money I lost, I still had more than what my initial investment was. So it was still a positive. Sure. And then I just, you know, bought projects that I believed in and have just hodled, as they say, hold on for dear life. So like, I don't follow it close anymore. Cause it's like, I look at it more now as like a long-term investment. Like, well, we'll see what happens in 10, 15, 20 years. But though I did get lucky because I wanted to get some new cameras, for what I'm doing here. I needed to get a new computer and, you know, YouTube doesn't pay very well. So I was like, well, I've got this, crypto is real high right now. Like Bitcoin was, you know, it was high. Ethereum was high. So I sold off. Not at the top, like I didn't time the top, but it was up there. You know what I mean? And I sold off some of that and, you know, invested in a new computer, got, you know, a new camera and some lenses. And now it's like, it's more than half what it was. So it's like, now it's time to start slowly buying back in.
Yeah. Oh man. But you know, it'll go back up. It always does.
But yeah, a bit of back to, you know, how that relates to tarantulas is just that technology is would be really cool to kind of implement. Yeah. And I even remember convincing a couple of tarantula dealers to accept Bitcoin, mainly because I had so much of it at the time. It's like, I really don't want to cash this out and have to like claim it on my taxes. Can I just buy tarantulas with Bitcoin? They're like, what's Bitcoin?
Oh man.
Well, let me sell you on this idea.
I'm kicking myself for not jumping into that sooner.
Yeah. I think I got my first Bitcoin. It was like around $1,800. Oh, I think it was like, yeah. $60,000 or something. It's like that's really good. But Ethereum was even better because like that was it was less than $50 and you know then it was selling in the thousands. So it's, you know, it's a volatile market, but beyond, but I think that's just, you know, growing pains. I think eventually,
I think so too.
It's going to stable out, and the technology is going to, not even for monetary purposes, like it's just going to be a great way to transfer ownership and keep track of things. And you know, I think that'd be really cool if you guys are working on some kind of a blockchain asset.
Yeah, we're excited about that. That's awesome. My brother-in-law is a genius about it, so he thinks he could integrate it into Micro Wilderness. So I'm hoping it works out.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So, do you have any other exciting projects that you know you're working on there at Micro Wilderness?
I mean, besides like just the various reptile projects we're hoping to launch or like produce and offer the end of this year. It's just the life of a daily tarantula breeder, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, have you got like any new species in that you're working with that's exciting?
So, yes. Let me grab the one next to me.
Okay. Yeah. I know we had talked a few weeks ago and you said you had a lot of versicolor slings that were going to be coming out in the near future.
So, we paired 60 female versicolors this season.
That's insane.
We've pulled 13 egg sacs so far.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity. So you got 60 females. And this is because I'm not a breeder. Sometimes I'm just curious about the stuff. So how many, like, do you have to have 60 males, or do you have like males doing pulling double duty, triple duty?
So I had six males.
Yeah.
And just over the span of like 2 months, I bred all the versicolors, giving the males a couple days in between.
So they're kind of just like studs. They're just
exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, what a good life, man.
Yeah, it's the way to go out, man. In your twilight years and just female after female after female.
Yeah. And so every single male except for one died of old age. One of them got munched.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But this is a species we just acquired this weekend.
Oh, my goodness.
Not a tarantula. Oh, here.
There you go.
This is a Colombian rainbow boa. It's a leucistic, so it has blue eyes. We picked up a male and female, and we're hoping to produce some of these guys pretty soon.
On the camera, it just looks white. Is it?
I know. I see that. It looks like a white blob.
It looks like a little albino snake. But you said it's a rainbow boa, so it's got some...
Colombian rainbow boa, yeah.
Colombian rainbow boa. I know nothing about those. Like, what... are they easy to keep? How big do they get? Like,
so they're super easy to keep. My friend's female is about 5 feet. This one's 3.5 feet.
Okay.
You're pretty easy boa species. They're pretty high humidity, so I keep them wet.
Yeah. I mean, that's like similar in size to like a ball python, right? I mean, they get around.
Yeah, I would say so. Just a little bit bigger, if anything. Other species. We just started working with some Johnny Cash eyes that I got from this weekend as well from the show.
Nice.
Yeah, we were in Sacramento, so a local man that I met over there has them in his property and caught me a bunch. Yeah, and he just said he wanted to see them in captivity, so he caught me two females, two males. They are not mature, so I don't know if I'm going to get to breeding them this year.
Right.
Yeah.
I think Tom Patterson sent me a Johnny Cashy.
Oh, that's right. Is that the sling you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, it is tiny. I put it in its enclosure. It's like, I'll see you in 5 years, buddy.
Well, if you want, I got an extra female here I could send you. Ooh. I only need one.
That would be pretty cool. I'm not going to lie. Yeah, you sent Tarantula Cat some pretty cool females over the years. I see that. And then, you know, we got into it the other week. I don't remember what it was. She was on one, like paranoid, hyperchondriac kind of thing. And I just started.
Was it the spider?
That's it. Yeah, she got bit.
The spider, the bear.
I just started busting her balls, like giving her a hard time, and so did everyone else in the chat. And she was like, "You know what, Wilderness Nate. I mean, she just called you Nate, but he was the only one that was nice to me. He is my only friend now."
I felt so bad because she thought it was a messed up spider. I was like, "No, that's one of the harmless house spiders here."
Yeah. Yeah, she was convinced. I was like, I am sure you're fine.
Yeah, no, she was okay. It ended up being a cut or something like that.
Yeah. It was funny. It was a funny. She's like, I know it's not a brown recluse. Like, but what is that? And I can't remember what I thought it was, like an elder. Essentially just a harmless house spider.
It was a black walleye.
Oh, okay.
Which is a type of mouse spider, harmless like house spider over here.
Gotcha. Yeah, that is not what I thought it was. But I didn't realize at the time it was like came in a bag of substrate from California or from that area from the West Coast. I thought it was like this is something that was in our closet. I was like, you're fine. But yeah, that was funny. She was just like, he's the only person that's nice to me. I'm like, oh, come on. but yeah, that would be cool. But yeah, I was just wondering, you know, like you've got those VersaColor slings. You reached out to me and offered to do like a fundraiser.
Yes, the Harmony House.
Yeah, are you still interested in doing that? Like,
absolutely. And not only that, I'm trying to gather other spiders to throw onto that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure how to do like an auction for that fundraiser, though. I want to do an auction to get as much money for the fundraiser.
Okay.
But if we can't figure it out, I just might list it onto my website as a fundraiser item.
That's cool. Yeah. When I mentioned, I contacted the assistant director. He's a friend of mine. And he's like, I'm not going to mention it to the director until like we have this in stone, because we want to like get her hopes up or something. Because sometimes those nonprofits, they're on a shoestring budget, and if they think money's coming in, they may start spending money that they don't actually have yet or something. So I was
we'll definitely try to raise some this fall for them.
Yeah. So I was like, well, we'll wait, see what happens. But he's like, yeah, we love the idea. They were really excited about it and very, very appreciative. And I was like, well, you know, I'll keep in touch with them and we'll figure it out. But he mentioned that they do auctions a lot, and they use a website, like some kind of, I can't remember the name of it now. He sent me a link, but yeah, it's like you post the stuff up on there and then people can auction and, Yeah, because they auction off like gift baskets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it does, like, because they're a nonprofit, it doesn't cost anything. They just, like, when the person's checking out, you know, they're putting in their payment information or whatever. Mm-hmm. The way they make money, it's kind of like, what's that everybody uses that one platform to raise money that it should be on? It's on the tip of my tongue. GoFundMe, you know, like on GoFundMe. Like you can, they try to get you to leave like a dollar tip or something like that to support their website. So like, that's the only way they're making money. And so I was like, yeah, I'll mention that to them. And I meant to do that, but since we're on a podcast talking face to face.
Oh, for sure. No, perfect time to mention it. So yeah, I definitely want to, if we could utilize their auction platform, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
I would love to do that.
And that way nobody's got to touch the money. It goes straight from the person that wins the auction right into their bank account, you know?
Correct.
That was one thing I was worried about, because like last time I did one for them, I did like a live stream and was like all super chats. I'll donate to them. But then when I did my taxes, I realized that was a mistake, because not only did like YouTube take 30% of, like, if you donated a dollar, YouTube took 30 cents and I only got 70 cents. But then that showed up in my bank account as income that I got taxed on. And then I donated it to them, and it was just a hassle to be like, to prove that that money was actually be a donation that's not taxed. I was like, next time I'm just not going to put my fingers.
Yeah,
on
that's
it.
Sweet. No, let's blow up this auction house when the spiders get in.
Yeah, that would be very cool. So like what you were talking about, just kind of people that weren't privy to our conversation, you were talking about, you got some VersaColor slings and stuff like that. You're going to make like packs, or I don't even know what the right word is. Like,
well, so yeah, I was thinking just, you know, putting groups of spiders together and putting them up. That'd be awesome at the auction house for Harmony House.
Yeah.
Then just we'll send them out.
Very cool. Yeah. So it'd be really cool and help support a good cause, because they do amazing work around here. And you know, I can't sing their praises enough.
And, you know, you really explained how much this organization means to you. And, you know, so I wanted to help out in any way I could.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like sometimes I get a little grief, because they're like, well, they help people. We want to donate to something that helps spiders. And it's like, I've tried. I have reached out to scientists. I have reached out to, reach out to Coyote Peterson and, you know, a lot of people that work in conservation and stuff like that, like trying to find an organization that, you know, either protects tarantulas in the wild, like, you know, had their habitats, or, you know, there's so many different ways, but like especially the couple of the scientists I've talked to on Twitter, they're like, there's a few organizations out there, but they don't want anything to do with people that keep them as pets or breed them or sell them or make YouTube videos about them. Like, you guys are the enemy. Even if you had $1 million, they would be like, I don't want it. We don't want it.
Yeah. And you know, I've faced that too. You know, I've tried to reach out to conservation groups here.
Yeah.
And because of who I am, they don't want to work with me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of frustrating, because it's like, we share a passion for these spiders, and
Sure.
You know, we could be working together. And that's like one of my biggest frustrations with the scientific community and the conservation community and the pet community is that we all love the same things. We all want to see the best for them, but for ideological, political, I don't know what the reason is technically, like, but just kind of seems like can't work together, can't get along because,
right.
You know, they're pointing the finger like, well, you guys are the problem. And we're pointing the finger like, no, you guys are the problem. I mean, not so much. I don't think the pet trade really calls the scientists a problem, but the fact right. that they don't want to work with anybody that keeps them as pets.
It can kind yeah. of and, you know, I'm just a guy who wants to help. You know, it's yeah. I'm not trying to get anything out of it, you know, but yeah, no, there's not a lot of collaboration between the two communities.
Yeah. And they recently came out with this paper. I'm sure that you saw that. It was a recently published paper that was yeah. talking about the pet trade detrimental impact on native populations.
And, I have, yes.
Yeah. And personally, it seemed pretty skewed. Like some of the information was just outdated already.
Correct.
But it was also, it seemed like there's a lot of assumption, like in the paper, they're saying we can't actually see how much of an inventory these businesses have, nor can we see how much they are selling, but right. we're assuming that it's around this many thousands. It's like, wow.
Who put that paper out?
It was a team of scientists. They were, it was yeah. out of, I want to say the Netherlands or, so, you know, it seemed like one of those Baltic, I don't know if that's the right word, Northern European countries, but they were like from all over the place, like the team mm-hmm. of scientists. And I went through the paper and looked up each person that contributed to it, like each one of the authors, and sure. sent them emails or, you know, however, like with some of them were only on LinkedIn. Some of them I could only access, like their only contact information was Twitter. And I tried to contact every single one of them. And then a couple other people, like because Wired reached out and wanted like a couple quotes from somebody in the pet hobby when they were doing a article on that. And yeah, I kind of got frustrated because like, I mean, I talked to that guy for over half an hour and we went back and forth for a day with email, probably a dozen emails back and forth. Oh, wow. And I felt like I really had a lot because sometimes I can be very long-winded and he like took everything I said and just like, well, here's a couple of sentences from Richard, but I mean, he did a good job. I'm not like knocking and he didn't misrepresent me or anything. But it was like, the only reason he got my name was because he reached out to a couple of like scientists and arachnologists.
I see.
And they were like, we don't want to get involved. We don't want to be on the record. Talk to this guy. And so they're like, a couple of people, referred me to you. And I was like, who? Yeah, since they didn't want to be involved, I'm not going to put their name out there, but they're very, sure. Kind of well-known arachnologists around the world.
Right, and right.
So I figured if they know who I am, then maybe some of the other scientists that made this paper might know who I am. And pretty much only like a couple of them, a couple of them just never responded. A few of them said like, we're not really interested in having a conversation with you. Because I was like reaching out, like pretty much saying like, I read your paper. I don't agree with it, all of mm-hmm. it, but some of it, but I do agree with some of like the aspects, I don't think that there should be mass collection, like wild collection. I think that we should do something to stop, especially some of these more, I don't want to say third world countries, but countries sure. that are a little more low income, or I don't even know the right word. They don't have as many, what's the right word? Opportunities that mm-hmm. People maybe in the United States do. And a quick way to make a buck is to go out into the jungle and capture 20 specimens and sell them into the pet trade.
Like, right.
It would be cool to work with somebody that can help protect those environments and protect those species and maybe set up some kind of, business or, arrangement to where they mm-hmm. can capture some and sell them. It's kind of like what they're doing in Mexico, but do them in Asian countries or South American countries, sure. like that. They're pretty much like, yeah, we don't want anything to do with you. One guy though, he actually agreed to come on the podcast and talk about one of the,
oh,
authors.
Wow.
He contributed to it. He helped do the study. He's like, arachnids aren't really my main area of focus, but I can definitely come on and talk about how we came up with these numbers and, what assumptions or, not assumptions isn't the right word. I feel like I'm not good. It's projections or maybe that's okay. a more scientific kind of way of saying sure. it. I don't know. I'm sure he will tell me no. To me, it just felt like we're guessing. And he was just like, it's not, we didn't just guess. Like we did some, he's like, I can show you the work essentially.
Okay.
But even then
I'm
like,
interested to see it.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But even then, yeah. he kind of alluded, like, you know, maybe they're not as accurate as they could be. He's like, sure. But the point wasn't give it a finite number as mm-hmm. much as it was to prove the point that there is a lot more going on in the pet trade than, you know, as far as like wild collection than maybe sure. some people are aware of. And they did have some good points about species that would be described and then within weeks or months, all of a sudden be for sale in Europe. It's like, how did that happen? Like,
well, that is kind of shady. Yeah.
And that's always something that, you know, it's embarrassing because there's like two sides. Like, you know, mm-hmm. new species comes out and it's like, oh, that's beautiful and rare and exotic and I want it. But it's also like, I know it was just recently described right. and isn't in the hobby. And when it all of a sudden shows up, there's like that moral dilemma. Like, do I do something I want mm-hmm. and get something I want, or do I try to be responsible and not be part of the problem, I guess?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. Cause that's, I mean, that's, I assume you doing what you do, you probably come into that, have that dilemma a lot more than someone like me, because
sure.
you yeah. have access to importing tarantulas from other countries. And
not only that, unscrupulous vendors yeah. will always like email me and ask if I want, you know, a giant group of wild caught blah, 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 you know? mainly from like Asia, I'll get like just random people offering me wild caught scorpions, wild caught centipedes on the, you know, the boatload.
Yeah. I even get those sometimes. And yeah. my response is like, okay, cop, I don't, yeah. that's like hitting me up and being like, you want to buy some weed on the internet or something? Like, I got some really good ecstasy. It's like, yeah you're in where? Like, and a lot of times they're from, you know, I got some people that hit me up in like from Russia, Japan, China, you know, that area of the world.
Right. But
with,
you know,
species,
that same
it's like, I don't have an import license. They're like, that's fine. That's like, okay, cop.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's because on that same vein, it's just, it's always like, hey, I could send it to you in food or I could send it to you in toys. I'm like, oh, come on, man. No, yeah. I have an import license. I do things legally.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it there is that, you know, like there's the offers and temptations, but it's just never worth it, you know?
Right. Yeah. And unfortunately, I feel like there are a few people in the hobby that will take that risk mm-hmm. and get busted. And then we all look. Like we do.
Yeah, that, it know? Makes the whole hobby look bad when it happens to one person.
Yeah.
And yeah, because I remember just a few months ago, did you hear about the Mexico smuggle where this guy taped like Gila monsters to his legs and a bunch of tarantulas and all
nope.
sorts of.
I missed that one. Jeez.
It was like 2 months ago, some guy got caught at the border because he taped a bunch of exotic animals all over his body.
Oh my gosh. Can you imagine? Being that border agent, patting him down like, what? Just move.
Yeah, what's that thing moving in your leg, man?
That is wild. Yeah, and I mean, I've seen plenty of news articles. Like, and it seems like usually it's the Philippines. Mm-hmm. People are like, the whatever their customs is, are opening up packages and like finding boxes of cereal with hundreds of little vials of spiderlings in them and stuff. And it's like, man, you know, but she, like, there's even been a few, and I'm not going to, we won't call anybody out by name, but I'm sure you probably know what I'm talking about. But there's a few smaller breeders or newer breeders maybe that have shown up, or dealers, I guess I should say, mm-hmm. that haven't been around a long time, don't have an import license, but have been offering some species for sale that nobody else has. And you're just like, there's no way you could have legally or ethically sourced that species that you're now
right.
proudly advertising for sale. It's like, you know,
yeah, and it's pretty obvious with those people too, because nobody else has them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but no, I agree. Yeah, I've been watching out for that too.
Yeah, and it sucks because, I mean, I've seen, been in the hobby long enough that you things are cyclical, you know? It's like, you see that behavior, usually that whoever that person is, they end up becoming kind of discredited, or they end up sure. getting arrested and going to jail or having serious fines or some kind of court order where they can't keep or sell exotic animals mm-hmm. and they disappear. But then a year later, somebody kind of takes their place. You know, somebody else right. has this bright idea of a way to make some quick money by importing some species, or maybe they don't even want to make money. They just really want that species. So they brown box it in the country. And, it's one level of stupidity to do that, to take that risk. It's another level of stupidity to openly brag about it and showcase it on social
media. Agreed.
It's like,
agreed.
You know, like, now you're being stupid and only harming yourself, and you've turned that into being stupid and harming the entire hobby. And, yes. you know, I've got some hate over the years because I kicked some people out of my groups that were posting pictures of species, obviously in their own collection in the United States that are not legal to be here. And some of them are like highly illegal, you know, like there's some, and it's weird stuff, like some mollusks or some snails or some like stick insects and stuff that are just like, there's no way anybody can get that in. Like they just don't put those permits out. There's not legal. If you're, I don't want my group being tainted. As you know, and
I think that's responsible to keep that out of the Tarantula Collective for sure.
Yeah. But not everybody agrees. there's one gentleman out there right now, and I use that word loosely, who just hates me and is doing, you know, like a daily campaign. Maybe not daily. I have a block now, so I don't even know what's being said, but I get sent screenshots like, hey, this dude's talking shit about you again. I'm like, oh God.
Man. Hey, send those to me later. I want to know.
I'm sure you probably got an idea, but it's like, I mean, just essentially they just think I'm like an arrogant elitist or something because I won't support them or let them do their thing. And it's like, it's not a personal thing. I just don't.
For sure.
You know, I just don't agree with your business practices right now, and I don't want to be involved or associated or in any way promoted. So I just cutting ties and not dealing with you. And if that makes me an arrogant asshole, then I've been called much worse. I've done much worse in my life. So that's all right. Man. But, you know, I'm glad that you were willing to come on and talk to me, man, because this is a conversation I've been wanting to have for a while, just because our brief interactions through messages or you do that thing, I guess, because you're busy, but. Like I'll send you a text and then you'll record a voice note and send it back to me.
Yeah, I do that with everybody.
but you know, you always seem like a nice guy, and we've known each other for years at this point. So we haven't like sat down and had a nice long conversation like this.
Yeah, and you know, I was really looking forward to doing this. Yeah, I'm sorry for blowing you off all these years from doing this. it's purely the camera fright.
I understand.
Yeah, but no, I had a great time talking to you today. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, definitely. And you're not the first. Like, don't feel bad. I would say half the people I reach out to you to come on the podcast, they're like, I don't want to be on camera and for everybody to see.
For sure.
And actually, the last podcast I recorded was with Gordon Riley. Do you know him? Mm-hmm. Venom Macro.
I don't.
He does a lot of, I got his book right here, Jeff Oliver and Gordon Riley, Venomous Words. It's a great book. It's like poetry. He's not paying me to promote this. I'm just really excited because I mean, look at those images. Like they're beautiful. So he's got like, you know, mainly scorpions and stuff, but he does this like cool macro photography. And then the Jeff Oliver writes these like nice little, not nice. They're like dark gothic kind of poems that like complement the, you know, it's a cool little book. And, but if you follow him on Instagram or social media, he never shows his face. He's like anonymous. He's got like, you know, it's like a Deadpool kind of logo or like face. And and he's like, I want to come on and promote the book and talk about it and talk about macro photography, but I want to maintain my anonymity. And so we just did this without video. It's just like he and I, it's an audio version. So he can still talk.
I was actually debating that too, whether if I wanted this as an audio thing. But nah, I just went full bore with it.
Well, I'm glad you did. I mean, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I was like, after recording that session with him, I was like, I might just go straight audio for the podcast because setting up the lights and the cameras and dealing with the editing the video and stuff is a lot of work. And I was like, if it's just the audio, it'd be less work. Yeah. And the majority of the people just listen instead of watch. So, you know, it may be good. So in the future, that may be something. But that's not how it is now. So I'm glad that you were willing to come on and get over that fear and be willing to talk and, you know, just kind of put a face to the name. A lot of people know you. They know Macro Wilderness. They buy. I hear so many good, you know, that's one thing I look at when I'm doing business with a company, especially a dealer. You know, I listen to what people say. Like they'll leave comments on YouTube videos, they'll send me messages or make posts, and overwhelmingly it has been positive.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, occasionally I'll get a nasty review from somebody. They're just like, I sent him a message an hour ago and he has not responded to me yet.
Oh my gosh.
I'm like, okay, you just need to get over yourself. Like,
I got a life too, guys.
It's like nobody's going to respond. Like these aren't your best friends, not your parents. They're not going to respond in and out. I think people just get used to Amazon and they're like, if I'm not immediately responded and my purchase doesn't ship the next day, then they're a scammer. It's like, no, that's just not how it works.
Yeah, you know, we get a lot of that too, because we don't ship every single day as well. We only ship Monday to Wednesday.
Yeah.
And people don't understand that, so they're freaking out about the overnight when Thursday happens and there's no package.
I think that's like one of the biggest misconceptions that I've seen. And I'm not even a dealer, but people are like, I paid for overnight shipping. On a Thursday, it should have been shipped overnight here on Friday. Like,
exactly.
That's not what overnight shipping means. It doesn't mean they're going to ship it immediately. It means
and when they ship it. We explain that a couple times a week too.
But you know, I think again, it's just where Amazon's ruined the world is that, you know, if they buy a book or you know, a T-shirt on Amazon, they pay for overnight. It'll be there the next day, and so I think they expect that with their tarantulas, but it's like, I don't know, it's not just this hobby. I hear that with dart frogs and snakes and all kinds of stuff. But
oh, for sure.
So before we get off here real quick, you know, we've talked about your website a lot. We promoted that. You're on Instagram. You're on Facebook. People can follow you, Micro Wilderness. Do you have like any expos coming up? Do you want to kind of shout out? People can come meet you in person?
So we have a big one coming up. It's the Anaheim Super Show. It's one of the biggest in Southern California. That is happening, I think, the 8th and 9th of next month, so 3 weeks from now. We also have one scheduled in August for San Mateo, San Francisco area. But after that, I'm open to suggestions, so just leave it on the comments below.
All right. Now, do you mainly just do the Southwest, like California?
Do California, Arizona, Nevada. We haven't ventured too much further than that. You know, I've considered doing Colorado, but it is quite the drive for us. But yeah, like just the Southwestern United States is my territory pretty much.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, it would be cool to see you at like an NARBC, but
yeah,
it's a lot easier for me to hop on a plane with a camera bag than it is to bring your entire inventory.
I have thought about going out, like especially if you and Kat are together at a convention again, like going out to just hanging out with you guys rather than vending, because I'd be a lot less stressful too.
That would be cool. Well, actually, I don't know if you've heard, it's we're going to be at Animal Con in Orlando second to last weekend in August. I think it's like the weekend of the 27th, August 27th. Let me look at calendar real quick, because I'm supposed to be promoting it, and I always forget to promote it because my mind doesn't go that far in the advance. It may be the 19th, 20th, and 21st, but don't quote me on that. I'll leave a link down below in the description or in the box for Animal Con. So, I mean,
for sure.
If you can go to that, that would be cool. It'd be cool to,
you know, I'm going to try my hardest, but the next couple months are actually my busiest herping seasons.
Oh, yeah.
So every weekend I'm out in the desert.
I'm just excited. I mean, Petco's going to be there. Ants Canada's going to be there.
Oh, God. Okay. So I might have to divert.
Brian Barczyk. Oh, man. So many different. I mean, a lot of invert.
So you said the 19th-ish?
I should just look it up.
Let me put that on my notes.
See, it's www.animalconusa, I believe, is the website. Animalconusa.com.
Cool.
You can find all of the... I mean, there's no live animal sales. Like, that's the weirdest... It's August 26th to the 28th. Mm-hmm. Okay, I was right the first time. That last weekend of August. And it's at a nice fancy resort there in Orlando. You know, so it's like you can go, like, there's a lot of stuff to do at the resort, but you can also go out to Disney World or Universal or any of that stuff you want to do. But, you know, the list of people, Adam from Wiccans Wicked Reptiles is going to be there. And embarrassingly, there's a lot of people I don't know. Alex from Tarantula Haven's going to be there.
Oh, nice. Nice.
I'm just kind of scrolling through real quick. Guys from Ohio Fish Rescue, Bill Strand from the Chameleon Academy podcast will be there. There's probably a lot of people that are much better known. The dude from, do you ever watch Tanked on Animal Planet?
Yeah.
That guy Brett is going to be there.
Sick.
that'll be cool. Yeah. I mean, Dave Kaufman, from Reptile Adventures, Rattle On. Yeah. So, I mean, there's just a whole bunch of cool. I guess they're cool. Some of them I don't know, but it's hard to know everybody. There's hundreds and hundreds of animal pet tubers out there. It's going to be exciting. There's going to be like, it's, you know, kind of like Comic-Con, you know, there'll be panels, there'll be meet and greets, there'll be discussions, there'll be Q&As, there'll be parties and all kinds of food and fun stuff, you know? So it's kind of just like a bunch of animal content creators hanging out and answering questions, meeting fans. And, you know, I think there's only like 400 tickets or something. So, I mean, it's a limited number. Yeah. But like you rent out the entire thing, I believe. like the entire little resort. And he's like, if this goes well, the next year there might be like 700 tickets. I don't remember.
Sure.
He told me. I did a podcast with him. I just had no recall, no short term memory, I guess. So there's a limited amount of tickets. We'll just say that. So there's a limited amount of tickets, and if it goes over well, the next year there'll be more tickets. And he's like, we might even have to go to a larger facility. But yeah, just kind of like VidCon, Comic Con, you know, that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, all right. Well, I might be going to Animal Con in August.
That would be awesome. It'd be cool. Even if you just come and hang out with me and Kat and Petco. And,
I would love to.
Yeah, hopefully Mikey from Ants Canada. We'll just have like a cool little invert, you know, hang.
I was actually trying to make it to that St. Louis show with y'all.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little while ago, but it just didn't work out.
Yeah, that was fun. That was like the first time I met Kat in person. Yeah. And I don't know if I've told this story, but I got into town. I flew in. She wanted to pick me up at the airport, and I was like, you know, I'm just weird with people. And I was like, I'll just rent a car. She's like, you don't need to rent a car. You're staying in the hotel where the convention is.
Yeah.
She's like, I can drive you around, but like, it just like that control thing. I was like, I want to have the ability to go where I need to go and not have to rely on somebody else. So I was like, I'll just rent a car. And she was like, well, come and meet us. And they were at this like little hipster restaurant bar.
Uh-huh.
And I show up and, you know, nervous. But she was much more nervous than I was. So that kind of like made me not as nervous, but like for at first she wouldn't even look at me. Like she's like looking down, kind of like talking to me until she got a couple drinks in her. Like when she was a little more lubricated, then we were laughing and having a good time, but it was weird, which is too, you know, I think that's a weird thing about YouTubers sometimes is more introverted than people like, you know, making content, put it on there in public, but in real life, we're like, I don't want to talk to anybody.
Yeah, I remember my first conversation with Kat, because I'm kind of introverted too. It was me, my old business partner, and Kat. Kat and I barely said anything, and my super extroverted business partner at the time was talking.
Yeah.
It was kind of awkward.
Just talking the entire time. But yeah, like this, I can talk like this for another couple more hours. But if we were in person, same. it would. There would definitely be a part where it would come to a point pretty quick where I'd be like, all right, I need to go away for a little bit, be by myself and recharge my social battery before I can be around you. So sometimes those expos can be a little frustrating or a little difficult, tiresome. But that one was nice in St. Louis just because it was mainly people were there to see her. And, you know, it wasn't nearly as crowded as the one that's in Tinley Park, like the one outside Chicago.
Right.
So, you know, it wasn't as, you know, shoulder to shoulder and massive. So there was a lot more downtime where we could just kind of hang out in the booth and cut up and laugh and stuff. But it would have been cool if you'd have been there. But hopefully we can see you again. And if not, if you can't come to Animal Con, I'm sure I got to get out to California and take you up on that offer because we need to get out there.
Definitely. That would be the trip of your lifetime, Richard.
Yeah, I agree. And go out, just kind of follow you around while you're out there herping and getting some cool footage. Because some of the pictures you take and post on social media are just beautiful. I'm jealous. I'm like, that land out there.
Well, oh, thank you so much.
Were you in some kind of salt flats at some point?
Oh, sorry. You broke up again. I'm getting some bad connection.
Yeah, we need to wrap up the podcast. I just real quick, I thought you were in some like salt flats or something like that. Was that... Maybe I just thought it was salt flats.
Sorry, one more time.
Salt flats.
Salt flats. Yeah. No, not recently. The last time I was in salt flats was a year ago. But I was over in New River, which was a riverbed that was dry.
Oh, okay. Maybe that was it. Or I could be remembering something from a year ago. My concept of time is skewed. Everything that's happened in the past 3 years feels like in the past 6 months. So.
Yeah, I know. It's all just merged together because of Corona.
Yeah. But dude, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a blast talking to you. I'm sure everybody has really appreciated your insight into breeding and just everything that we've talked about. So it's great having you on, man.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, I will leave a link down below in the description. If you're watching this on YouTube, you can see Micro Wilderness's website scrolling across the bottom there. And from his website, you can find all of his links to social media, as well as his very cool inventory of species that are available for sale. Definitely a business I highly recommend. And I believe if you use the code TTC10 at checkout, it's going to save you 10% off your entire order. So, you know, make sure you take advantage of that. Save a little bit of money, support an amazing dealer here in the hobby in the United States. And it's been a good time. So check the show notes. Links to everything will be down there. If you're on YouTube and you're listening to this, make sure you hit that subscribe button. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're listening, be sure you're following the Tarantula Collective, man. Nate, again, thank you. Say goodbye to everybody, and we will get out of here.
Hey, have a good one, guys. Thank you so much for watching.
Yeah, thank you, guys. And we'll see you in the next podcast. Goodbye. Better now. Check 1, 2. Check.
Yeah, I can hear you much better. Okay. Now.
Awesome.
Sick.